You're listening to Technology Whisperers with myself, Alistair Ross, and
Sean Muller.
And this is episode 5 of season 2. And today we're joined with Tim Warren of Ambit. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. Nice to meet you both.
Excellent. Excellent. And Tim, let's just get kicked into it straight away. Who are you? And what is Ambit?
Ambit. Yeah, so I'm Tim Warren. I'm one of the co-founders and also CEO of Ambit. And what we do is we use artificial intelligence to solve customer problems. So we create chatbots. And so we use conversational AI now. No one had heard of it a couple of years ago, and now everyone's heard of it because of ChatGPT. So I am currently managing all the big changes that are happening in our company, in the industry, and every industry, which is going to be dramatically changed by this tech.
Yeah. So am I right in saying then you're a bit of a trendsetter?
I just worked out a way of describing this. I used to think that I was uncool, but I've worked out that I'm not. I'm just early to everything. So
there you go.
Yeah, I was a musician in school, and musicians at school are uncool. But musicians where they're 19 and 20 in a band and they're skinhead riding a motorbike are very cool. So I was early to that. And then I got into this internet thing and people said, what is this piece of wizardry? And I said, it's just that. It's magic. And then that was in 96. And then by 2001, 2002, everyone called me lucky. Yeah. So again, I got into this geek thing, and then it turned out maybe that was a good thing to do. So when I got into AI in 2016, I mean, I'd studied it, but I launched a company around 2016, 2017. I was early, and now I'm cool, apparently. But someone else's words, so I can use them.
Sucks to be you.
It's terrible. So you know what? Look at what I'm wearing. And then put that in the cupboard for 5-6 years, and
it'd be golden.
Yeah. To the listeners, obviously we're on a podcast here. You can't see what Tim is wearing, but you know, I don't think it's that uncool. I think he's, you know.
Oh, that's good.
It's that little floral patterns. I admit to myself that I have floral patterns, and I'm okay with it.
Well, I'll tell you about these jeans, given that you asked. Well, you didn't, but I made it up like ChatGPT makes it. Thanks. So I bought these jeans 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then I started running, and I undergrew them as, and I got so slim I couldn't wear them. So I put them away. Yeah. And then COVID hit.
Yeah.
And the food hit. Mm. And all of a sudden I can wear these jeans again. And through that time, the styles of jeans have changed. They're back in fashion.
Back
now.
In fashion.
Again. Not uncool, just early.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a beat that you're wearing the fat jeans again.
I think those weren't my words.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would have, you know, I've got legions of people who think I've got a face for radio, and no issue with my jeans.
I also have been told that I have a face for radio, and the irony is that I've been on radio for many, many years in my life. So unfortunate that is. But
I was
also
going to say you've got a voice for silent movies, but you know, hey.
Yeah.
Sean and his wife beg to differ on that, which is strange, but you know, I don't know either way. But yes, I certainly went through the really fat stage. Tim's not fat. I'm just pulling his leg.
But are you saying you've moved on from that?
Well, I was
you know, I can see you, right?
I was the fat boy, and then then I went slim, so I was fat boy slim,
right?
The uncool version.
Oh yeah.
And then I now, because of COVID, just like yourself, yeah, I kept around a few pairs of, you know, 36 waist, thinking I'll never get back into them, and unfortunately I'm trying my best to get back out of those. But yes, I know the feeling. No, I know the
very
feeling.
Good. Oh, fat boy slim, he's cool and cool.
Yeah, yeah. I went to a gig of his fairly recently, and there was a lot of people my age there. Yeah. And I thought, okay, my time has come around. I might be cool again. You know, not really.
So do you always just talk about how bad people are at things? And is this the tech podcast?
Tim, that's just the Scottish in him.
That's yeah, right. Yeah. We're brutal. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, Sean, I hid all of my whiskey before he came over.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. That's
a safe thing to do. Yeah.
It's probably a good idea.
No, very good.
So, you know, Tim, you Ambit was actually doing really successful with chatbot developing, and yeah, you made the point before ChatGPT became a thing. I mean, you and I know that large language models have been around for quite a while, but whether or not they had been trained up to a level that they were actually good from a generative AI perspective or not. And you mentioned the fact that you're now pivoting into using those more generative AI, conversational AI within it. But you were wildly successful with Ambit, both in New Zealand and overseas.
Yeah,
with what you were doing before.
Hey, I love that term, wildly successful. I haven't been accused of being that before. But I'll take it. So thank you for that. So yeah, look, we built a great business with some amazing brands, both in New Zealand and further. And it was focused around that customer service. So
yeah,
great, you know, amazing companies like various companies of the Warehouse Group, Hallensteins, Glassons, Tower, Simplicity, KiwiSaver. You know, the list goes on. And we're really fortunate that we built a product and a company to operate at that highest level. And I always aim to keep us operating at that really high level from, you know, the way we work with our team, the way we work with our customers, et cetera. So we pitched into that really at that top level.
Yeah.
And from there, we've got a customer in Canada. We've got a few customers in Australia, including Dermalogica and Konica Minolta and a few others. So yeah, look, the business grew. We got up to about 27, 28 people on the team. And when ChatGPT came out, as you said, Sean, we were certainly aware of it. We were working with large language models through a range of ways. And then all of a sudden it was the best bit of marketing ever, by the nature of putting out someone that apparently, I think the series of events was, someone saw it, there was a tweet, within an hour there's 10,000, within 24 hours there's 100,000, fastest thing to ever get to a million users, and it's gone beyond. So it was the marketing of it, yeah.
Yeah, so in that vein, I mean, because I've said this, but I mean, until recently I've been doing consulting, so consultants like to say little pippy quotes and stuff, but it really feels like that ChatGPT has created an iPhone moment for AI. Now, do you see that? I mean, are you seeing, because what I was seeing when I was doing consulting, and it is in the current company I'm in as well, is that business executives who know nothing about technology, they're not asking about cloud anymore. Yeah. They're not asking about data analytics. They actually want to know when we're going to implement AI.
Yeah. I do agree, but I think it's much, much bigger. So if I put it on the scale of something, this is like the wheel of fire. This is bigger than the internet, right? So it happens to be hosted on the internet and you need access to things, but it's what you can do with the tool, right? And it's an amazing tool. And the reason is that I think it's that big is that this is the first time we've created something where we can literally talk to it and it can guide us. Before that, we've had the steam engine, we've had hammers, we've had, you know, whatever it is, but it kind of does a function, but it can't shape or control itself, and now this thing can, which is pretty fabulous. Back to that question you asked, the people before, they didn't really want to talk tech, and now they say, when are we doing AI?
Yeah,
the amazing thing, they can ask those same questions of the AI itself
and get an answer.
So And I don't so much believe in the existential threat to humanity, but in terms of our current operating structure for humanity, in terms of the way roles are positioned, and, you know, a couple of my favorite topics, which are the future of education and the future of work, they're changing massively. So is it an iPhone moment? Yes, in that epochal kind of a way, because it's jumped the chasm from being a techie thing to the thing that just about everyone, I mean, grandma's cooking recipes with this thing.
And
to throw some bleach in there, it's going to be really weird. The grandkids might not do so good. But the point is that grandma's using it. And I don't think a lot of grandmas are using my previous technology. But in terms of the way we use it and rebuild our company to, again, operate brilliant customer service, but do it with in a generative AI fashion, it's amazing how fast everyone's having to move, including us.
Do you feel that OpenAI has cast a shadow over Ambit, or do you feel like it's actually provided you some free marketing?
A shadow in that elephant over an ant kind of a way. I mean, the scale of that company is so enormous, they don't even know where, and I think they would admit this, they don't know where their shadow lands. So what it has done, it's changed the field where, I mean, really, it's just a year ago that it didn't exist or it hadn't been released. It's just a year ago, less than a year ago. 10 months ago. So back then, we talked about solutions and customers, and it's kind of like, it does a thing. It's a little bit like Zendesk, maybe a bit better at this and not quite as good at that. But it was very much push. And now you've got this pull where, because, and it was the ultimate non-marketing. I mean, marketers would hate the way it was released, because it was released with no marketing at all.
Well, it was guerrilla marketing. Yeah, it was just, we're going to release it and then we're just going to let it do what it does.
It was actually classic viral, classic word of mouth, and it did its job. So I do believe that the way they released it was a bit irresponsible. I wouldn't have done that if I had something that was that powerful. We were playing around the edges, right? But we didn't have something which had so much power as the thing that they released. And while you can joke about the fact that, you know, it gets this wrong and it gets that wrong, so do I.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I get tons of stuff wrong all the time. You only got to get 51% right to be on the correct side of things, right? And it's a lot higher than that.
Mm.
Yeah, it's one of the things. Interestingly, I did some consulting at New Zealand Police a little while back, and it was one of the things of, well, they said at that time, the AI has to get 100%. And I said, but humans average around 85%. They have to hear it multiple times, and they play it back in their head and play it back in their head till they get to something that's good enough for them to move forward. And even then, sometimes we go forward with bad information because we didn't quite hear everything. So if the AI is getting 92, 95% correct, that's better than a human.
Yeah, that's right. I think we've experienced this with our existing technology, which is where it would be very accurate, but your customers would find one issue where it wasn't quite what was expected, and they held us to a very high standard. Now, I don't know why people have dropped that expectation. It's almost like the TikTok brigade, right? In the old days, we had like facts, and facts were facts, and then there was fiction, and they were different. And now it's all jumbled together. And the TikTok generation really don't give a toss. But there was a recent poll, when I say recent, 6 months, which is approximately infinity in AI at the moment, infinite time, but a poll about TikTok. And it said that I think the majority of American teenagers got all of their news from TikTok. That was their version of what's actually happening. And, you know, when facts become subjective, you end up in a very unusual situation. And I've had unusual discussions with, just say, people of my kids' age. And they're absolutely determined they're right because they've seen it from multiple sources. But all of those sources are non-credible to me. But isn't it interesting that somehow the release of a particular tool, a particular language model in a certain way, and then all of a sudden, and I think it's because it was conversation driven, but all of a sudden people don't care about accuracy anymore. They just want to get on that bus.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things is that it was not just conversational, but it actually gave you something back that was formatted correctly. We look at some of the large language models. I've used GPT-2, GPT-3. I was a beta tester for ChatGPT. If you go back far enough, and they would give you little snippets, but they seemed like almost dialogue flow like interactions.
Yeah.
Whereas ChatGPT, you say, "Hey, write me a email to my boss," and it structured the response so that you could literally just copy and paste it into an email, and it was done. I think some of it was for OpenAI was that. It was that, you know, the framework and formatting around how they did the conversational response.
The personality that it had as well, I think, is something that we hadn't really seen before November of last year.
And it's really interesting. Google's response, which was Bard, they tried to do it more in this kind of magazine style formatting. Yeah. And it was much more like an article that you'd search for. And they missed the thing, which is that I think the brilliance of ChatGPT, I think you've summed it up well there, actually, Sean, which is the brilliance of ChatGPT was it was so simple. It was just conversation. And I know we're going multimodal now, and it's going to be able to look and see and feel and smell and whatever the other things are. But it started with something that is the core of what we do, the storytelling ability where you can ask something and you get something unique back. It's like, I know that when people like us, who know quite a bit about it, we are blown away. It's like they've really achieved something. I mean, I think that's probably what happened. Going back to that iPhone moment, I think we saw all kinds of phones. And then when the iPhone came out, it's like, that's it. They've cracked it. Get rid of that keyboard that everyone thinks they love.
Yeah.
No one misses it. Few people miss their BlackBerry, but, you know,
yeah,
really, they wouldn't have one.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. No, no, I completely agree with you. Now, I want to shift a little bit because we've been talking about Gen AI in the form of ChatGPT, but I'm going to be a little controversial here, and I'm going to make a statement, and I want to get your opinion about that statement. And that statement is that Gen AI is just the cream on the top. That actual real AI, transformative business transformation AI, is really the story, but Gen AI is just the cream on the top that makes it easier for us to take advantage of all of the AI in the background. Now, the general public and the business, they see Gen AI and they want Gen AI. But where we're really going to see the next couple years transformation is all AI enabling all of those back-end processes. It's not just the Gen AI portion. It's giving data to that Gen AI thin layer of cream over the top to be able to do things that we've never been able to do before.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think what it's done is it's made it accessible. And I've heard these other terms, commoditized, democratized. I don't really like those. I think the point is that it made it
accessible is right. Yeah.
And it's made it understandable because it's the easiest thing. One of the two basic skills we have as people, we can walk, we can talk. Right. So talk and conversation is so natural. It's been so hard. We've had to adapt to the computer. You think all of the stuff we use, typing and all that kind of stuff, it is all about the limitations of the computer. We didn't need keyboards for communicating. We only needed them to communicate to a
computer. Yeah.
So when you take that away, and okay, sure, we still type in, but voice is coming and all that. When you type something in, an uninformed question, and then it corrects your question and gives you an answer, it is really quite something. But I do agree. I think that is just the bit that lets people understand it. And you know what? Yep. Do you remember that you didn't used to have blue LEDs? So we didn't have LED TVs. And then that dude invented the blue LED and he won a Nobel Prize for it. And then all of a sudden, if you had, and I'm looking at your microphone here, it's got a blue LED on it. If you had a cool, expensive piece of tech, it had to have a blue LED on it. That's how you showed that it was the best. So ChatGPT is kind of like the blue LED version.
Yeah.
Everyone understands, oh, that's the expensive bit. Now, every TV that you get has got a million blue LEDs in it, right? Because it makes up a pixel. And they've been commoditized. But it's coming to the stage where everyone can understand it. And it's enabled a shift to occur because these companies that have been doing incredible stuff in machine learning for the last number of years.
Yeah.
I mean, ML has really been a big thing, and data science has been a big thing for the last decade.
Oh, yeah. Well, advanced analytics using machine learning. We've been able to predict data in ways that's been massively powerful, but it's very difficult to consume it.
Yes. This is the tricky thing. So I think humans are bad with bandwidth, right? We've got a big old computer up here in our head, but we don't have a whole lot of storage and we have an incredibly low bandwidth, right? We can see a picture, but we can't really, it takes a long time to paint a picture, even if you can. So we've got something where we can almost outsource that limitation of bandwidth by using, you know, a conversational way of getting something else to do the work. But underneath that, you know, the guts of, if you start reading about, and this stuff is beyond me, I've done computer science, but you start reading about the way that these, you know, massive transforms work, the transformer and the attention model, it's exceedingly sophisticated and it's massive, right? It's a scale. Everything we've done up to now has kind of led to it. But you're right, ChatGPT gives people a glimpse. I think that's a good analogy, a glimpse of a little bit of cream. But underneath, there's a whole lot of a lot of real stuff, real learning.
Mm. Yeah, because I think we're going to see it. So transforming that cream layer, the ChatGPT or Gen AI over the top of it, gives us a nice, easy way to interact with it. But we're going to start transforming everything we do with AI underneath the cover, and the Gen AI is just going to give us that interface to be able to talk to it.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's used as a generic term at the moment, isn't it? Just because it is accessible, but it's general, it's generative, it's, you know, lots of gen broad words, right? But some of the immediate things will be deep and opaque to most people. But this is probably enabling it, because now if you're an AI company and you hit at the right time, you can raise $1 billion, like Full Anthropic. Like Anthropic just rose $4 billion from Amazon.
Okay. But that's, in technology, and Alistair, you can talk a little bit about this, but that's the way it's been. I mean, if you talk to the business people, they don't know how their ERP system works under the covers.
Yeah.
They just know that they have an interface that allows them to record sales and to track those sales through the delivery process and stuff. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think this is making it easier for us to, and that I love the grandma comment. I had a good friend of my wife said to her, she goes, I don't know what to get for the week. She goes, why don't you ask ChatGPT to put a menu together for you? And she did it. And she goes, this is brilliant.
And it's good.
Yeah.
It's not just like it does anything. Oh, it's baked beans on toast, it's spaghetti on toast, and it's tuna on toast. Now, these are good things. I really early on with generative AI, I started getting pretty excited by it. And I thought, I'm going to test it. And there's a classic test I love, because it's a different mode to get it to give you some kind of food output. And so I told it what I had, and I said, you know, create me a recipe. And it did some things that really do pass the smartness test, right?
Yeah.
So it didn't use everything that I said that I had. It just used the things that actually worked together. And I was going to cook a T-bone, and I said, I want to sear a T-bone steak. I've got a barbecue, and I've got a whole bunch of herbs, blah, blah, blah. And I made it, and it was good. It even got the time right, okay?
Yeah.
So that's phenomenal.
Yeah. It used to be the Turing test, and now it's moved on quite a lot from that, hasn't it?
Yeah. You got any more of your outlandish statements, which don't seem outlandish?
I have all kinds of outlandish statements. But look, I think Alistair and I'd really like to hear your opinion of what AI, and I mean, you've been in the AI business in New Zealand for quite a while.
Mm.
And I know that you have been you've been successful in New Zealand, but you've also been successful overseas. And I have a lot of startup friends and, you know, VCs in New Zealand that talk about the fact that if you're a startup in New Zealand, you're aiming overseas, you're not aiming in New Zealand. What do you think that AI market looks like in New Zealand? And, you know, is it that New Zealand has something unique from an AI perspective? I mean, we have a history, right? Weka was created here. Soul Machines was, you know, Ambit was started here. So we punch above our weight class for a 5 million person country. But are those just anecdotal things, or is this something that could become an industry in New Zealand in a way that would be useful to New Zealand?
That's a good question. Because could it become an industry? Yes, if there's good, strong support for it. And, you know, it's election time coming up, so there's all kinds of policy being discussed at the moment. And I'd like to see some more substantive policy in this area. Mm. I haven't seen a lot, really. But could New Zealand become a leader in this space? Yes, absolutely. Just as Israel pitched itself and became a leader in the security space. And it's an area you two know a lot about. So security and instant messaging, I mean, the very original ICQ was out of Israel and many others. So New Zealand could do this. Have we got something special that's enabled? You know, do we punch above our weight? I think we've got a couple of leaders in this area in New Zealand, but I think that's probably despite what we've got, because we have in New Zealand is essentially a very high cost of capital. It's very hard to raise money here. And this is a standard thing. We'll be competing with a company that's, you know, say we've raised $1.5 million. We'll be competing with a company like Ada, one of our competitors, who's raised, say, 100. People expect the same results.
Yeah.
So my investors will say, oh, why didn't you grow at this rate? Why don't you have 100 people on your team? Why don't you do this? And I'll say, well, you know, very simply, we don't have the capital. We were forced very early we didn't get much time to innovate or iterate product, because we had to get out and start earning, because we'd run out of money, And then what have we done well? I think what New Zealand companies have done well, we do have a small network, but our networks tend to be, you know, very highly trusting. You build it up over time. And I've sold to people, and I've worked with people in the industry where I've known them and I've worked with them for 10 years plus. Now, I think that's actually, I've lived and worked in New York. I think it'd be a bit harder in New York. unless you've been here all your life, maybe, but it could be a bit harder in New York. People aren't as connected in that familial way. As we were talking about, New York's a big melting pot. People go there and they drink a lot of champagne in their 20s and then they kind of move to the suburbs or something. But
yeah,
in New Zealand, I think there's aspects that we can take advantage of there. But I think that the New Zealand culture has delivered people with big ideas. And I think of people like Peter Beck and I think of Allbirds, but I don't think those ideas can really be truly built in New Zealand. We're quick to take credit, but we're slow to invest capital. And I find that really tough. I only invest in New Zealand companies because I know how hard it is to get it. But so often I'll be talking to a company and my co-investors are trying to pull their valuation down from 2 million to 1.5 million. And I just say to my co-investors, I say, all that does is means they just run out of money quicker. All it does. Yeah. And so I don't think, again, I think investors here are pretty quick to take credit, like I said, but I don't know of any companies that are successful without taking overseas money. And it's not that the money isn't here. And there, that said, there's a few extremely supportive people. The Levine family are very supportive. Stephen Tindall and his K1W1. I think some of them do an excellent job, very strong supporting. But the VCs or, you know, whatever it might be is very tough. And I'll give you some examples. You know, through COVID, there were a few contracts awarded under emergency powers to non-New Zealand companies when New Zealand companies could have done the same job. You know, that, I don't know if you went through the booking system for you to get your jab. It cost us, I think it was, what is it, $30 million? And it was clearly a load of trash, wasn't used. And I ended up ringing the place and they said, oh, just walk up. No one can get through the booking system, so no one's turning up.
Yep.
So that's a good example where, are there big companies here? Yes. You could have gone to Datacom if you wanted a big company.
Well, yeah, exactly.
For what I saw, you could have gone to a pretty small company as well or built it for free on Squarespace. But there's this assumption that, oh, it's New Zealand, it can't be very good. So we often find ourselves in the position where we're competing with a global major. When I say global, it's Salesforce or Google.
Mm. Yeah. And
then all they do, the New Zealand companies, is squeeze us on price.
Yeah.
And then they tell us that the global doesn't give them good service. So it's pretty tough. It's very hard to get the dollar here. If I started Ambit again, I'd found it in a different country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that it's easy to found a company here in New Zealand and regulation-wise, company stand-up is fairly transparent. But yeah, that's my experience as well.
It's really easy if you want to be a Sparky or something like that.
Yeah.
It's designed for a trades and a services type industry. If you do that, you can be up and running by the end of the day. And I did. I set up the company, registered the domain name, set up the domain, open banking, all within one day.
Yeah.
And then it got hard. So I applaud it. If you're going to, you know, if you're going to be at the home business and sell cakes on a Saturday afternoon, super easy. If you want to build a global R&D business, super hard. And it's, you know what it is? With money, you can get almost everything else you need. It's, people are a bit fickle with investment here. It does make it a bit tough.
So in terms of ethics in AI, obviously that's something that we have a lot of questions about. What's your take on ethics and security and governance in AI right now?
Oh, it's Wild West at the moment.
Yes.
I mean, I've got this theory of the different hats. So the white hat, and in the early days of the internet, everyone was white hat. You could trust everyone. You need to buy something, you couldn't do it from here. They'd pay for it on their credit card and you could send them a check for someone you've never met. Those were us white hat people in those early days. It comes from the cowboy metaphor where the good cowboys always wear the white hats. And then you get the grey hat people, and they're the people who are not so much building the infrastructure as we were, but they're doing commercial things. And, you know, they will work out, they probably want to do the right thing, but they might not always. But they're not deliberately trying to do the wrong thing. And then you get the black hats, right? The thing is with AI this time, with Gen AI, is that everything's moving so incredibly fast. You know, the uptake of ChatGPT was, you know, 1 month compared to 10 years of internet uptake, right? It's pretty extraordinary. So in that time, I think ethics develop over time. Because what happens is you see people, it's like having a child. You see a child and they wobble a bit and maybe they fall down to one knee and then they get up and then they're walking, right?
but they need to learn from some of those mistakes. But you imagine if a child had a day to learn to walk and then they're out there, it's going to be a bit tough. And I think that's where we are with AI and ethics. And I don't think at the moment that the people who are leading it, and I like to think that I'm on the, at least on the periphery of that, I don't think the people who are leading it want to do anything wrong. I think they want to do the right things, but we haven't had time because, you know what? Our brains are kind of slow. But the problem is that we now have created a system that can do its own thinking, right? So when we created books and that kind of thing, information could move and it could multiply. Now the information has learned to think, right? Yeah. So it doesn't actually so much need us. What that means, given a black hat, you could, and I'm not going to go through anything here in case someone uses it as a template, but you can very quickly work out how to generate something that is not cool, that is illicit, illegal, or whatever. Now, there are going to be new crimes that we just haven't had yet. We don't even have names for what they are. Obviously, that's what happens. Web 1 was people just repeating pre-Web 1, but just with some digital bits and pieces. Right. Yeah. Web 2 started to move on from that. Web 3 is more like, hey, there's entirely different business models where you can buy and sell virtual assets in a virtual world. It's a whole different story. The equivalent in an ethics setting is that, like nothing I've ever seen before, it's moved so fast that the people who genuinely know what they're doing, like, and I'll use the example of Sam Altman and Bill Gates and this kind of thing, they're asking for it. And I was listening to a discussion about this morning, actually, and the problem is they're doing a lot of asking, they're doing a lot of talking, but do you know we're 6 months on from when that group of 35,000 people around the world signed a big letter saying we need to pause for 6 months? Nothing happened. Nothing. We talked. There was
Tim, it's even worse than that. One of the signers of that decided to start a new AI company.
Of course. Well, we're very good as a species of ignoring our long term for the short term. And if someone says, everyone's got a number, right? It's like, how much to take the letter out of someone's mailbox? I won't do it. What if I give you $1 billion, okay, I'll go grab that letter.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, I want the whole street for that $1 billion. Okay, I'll do the whole street. It's pretty easy to work out someone's number. And that's where I think you need to build up ethics and values in this area. So my approach to that would be having a standard level of expectations that people are building into their LLMs, into their large models. And yes, these things need definition. But my thought would be, and Isaac Asimov had those three laws of robots, right? And it's like, first, a robot must not hurt a human, right? We've moved on a little bit from calling them robots now, but AI or intelligence must not. And you can build up from there. And then a global commitment and a compact, I would imagine, through the United Nations, just like the principles for responsible investment. I believe there should be a United Nations, you know, a group of all nations committing to do it. And this is really tricky because it's not about the 90%. It's about the 10%. It's about the North Koreas and the Putins and the, you know, those edge states. Well, let's create incentives for them to fall in line, like making it available. But maybe we make it available in a way that is cost effective so they don't need to develop their own. I don't know what it is. Then do you leave all of the, essentially, you know, you think of a company like NVIDIA, almost has a complete stranglehold on the world because they run the high-speed hardware. And your stage where that's one of the most globally fundamental stocks at the moment for the development of this. If I was the US government, I'd be taking that private. That is not what the US does traditionally.
Right.
But I will put money on it that people will start talking about this because we haven't gone out to space and found the alien. We've created the new intelligence and we're in the position where it can grow and develop itself. It can write its own code. OpenAI has decided it's a great idea to connect it to every phone in the world with a microphone and a camera. So it's everywhere, it can see everything, hear everything. The kind of things that need to be done are these, call them ethical governance rules where all languages are trained from a base set of rules, and there is a way of turning them off or defeating them if they do not meet certain ethical levels. That's hard, though. because little bits of AI have snuck into everything. I mean, most people's first experience was predictive text. Mm. They forget about it now. That is all an LLM is. It just predicts the next word. It's just a little bit better than that one running inside your keyboard. But that's all it is. And so it's there. So how do you do this? You kind of need to turn the whole internet off in one go. It's unlikely that's going to happen. But, you know, was it OpenAI were advertising for a kill switch engineer? Pretty interesting stuff. But I do not believe, I'll just talk about briefly the progression of AI. At the end of last year, the 30th of November, 2022, and a day that will live in infamy, because that's when ChatGPT took AI, general AI, to the masses, right? At that stage, it could fairly reliably pass high school exams.
Yep.
But it had occasional glitches. Now it can fairly reliably pass every undergraduate degree. Including the bar, right? Moore's Law suggests that, I mean, rough numbers, that it will double in capability every 2 years, and he revised that down to 18 months. So if it doubles in capability every 2 years, and it's already got more degrees than me, in 1 year, it will be at that kind of PhD level. In 1 year after that, it will be beyond human comprehension.
And it retains everything it learns.
All knowledge for all time.
Yeah.
And here's a problem. What we're doing when we build LLMs and when we build these brain kind of comparators, we're trying to build these models of the way the human brain works in many ways. We do not understand the human brain.
Yeah.
But we're trying to build something that we don't understand. And do you remember when the dinosaurs were first discovered in the 1800s and they just jumbled all kinds of bones together? And you see photos of what they were trying to do. They had no idea. No idea, no reference point. They did terrible, terrible things. Paleontologists now are very upset by it. It's only when we started finding complete ones, they were trying to build something that looked like they had today, and they were nothing like it. So I do think it's a problem modeling something that we don't understand. And it's not that I think we understand 90% of the human brain. I think we understand about 10%. I've got this personal view I formed over time that I think the human brain, or brains in general, but talking about the human brain, I think they're probably some kind of quantum computer that can, well, we call it a quantum computer, that can manage information in multiple states. And that's how we manage to store so much data and pull it out in these weird ways. Like, do you know how hard it is to be able to calculate how hard you need to throw a tennis ball to throw it in your neighbor's window? A human just throws it in. You know, we call it muscle memory. It's actually everything except muscle, isn't it?
Mm.
It's actually this extraordinary calculation. This is actually ballistics, funnily enough. I told you we talk about something random.
Yeah, ballistics, there you go.
Was the origin of computing, because the calculus gets so hard, it got beyond people. So they created a computer, and then they realized, we don't just work it out one, you know, ballistic trajectory at a time. We can do millions. So these the early computers were first developed to create artillery trajectory tables.
Yeah, I remember. So before the Manhattan Project, Feynman worked on those ballistic models for the artillery at the beginning of World War II. Yeah. And he said in an interview that, what he was seeing was the groundbreaking concept of how a computer could work and could give you answers at scale. I mean, they were very mechanical computers at that time, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, imagine what it takes a baseball player to hit a pitched ball.
Yeah.
With the ball moving 90 miles an hour.
The better they are, the less thinking they do. And this is why I think there's a model of the brain that far exceeds what we can actually understand. There's a whole lot of information theory, fantastic things around this, around the way you have to model something. We won't go into that, although that'd be a fun discussion as well. But if you translate that, pick that up to development of computers, and I think you grabbed it there, it's the scale. But we've got now two dimensions. It's not just the speed, because with the first computers, they were doing things that could already be done, but faster. Right, and that's when calculus really found its footing, was being able to work this out with computers. But with AI, it's not only a quantity, so you can do it faster, it's a quality, so you can do it better.
Yeah.
And that's where I think we've got a 6-month window before artificial intelligence is more intelligent than any human that's ever lived. About a 6 month window, maybe it's around 5 months, looking at the progression of what we've seen in the last 8 to 10 months.
So there's so many naysayers out there who believe that this is the beginning of the end. They see Judgment Day only a few years off, and obviously none of us can predict the future. But we know right now we're on the precipice of useful quantum computing, and it's exponentially more powerful than everything we have today, just because of the way that quantum computing works. So then we add AI to that. Do you have any idea of what in the next 5 to 10 years, with the advent of quantum, general quantum computing plus AI, what we could be talking about here? Or is it just too far away for our brains to comprehend?
Again, like quantum computing, I can retain two states at once that completely conflict. I think it's actually one of the secrets to what I've done through leadership at different times, is that I can maintain these different ideas that conflict at the same time. So onto the question, there is a possibility, I believe, that quantum computing could be a little bit like fission, nuclear fission. It's always just 12 months away. And since I've been following it, you know, we get qubits that get bigger and bigger and bigger, but there's only particular things that they can do. They're very, very selective. So you said something critical there, general quantum computing. Yeah. We get general quantum computing and you can buy it and it's built into something you can use, then that's a holy shit moment. And I'll tell you what.
All bets are off.
All cryptography essentially broken, that we know of, essentially becomes useless at that stage.
Yeah.
That'll make it interesting for people in cybersecurity, won't it?
Very.
Yeah. So I did look at that when there was an announcement about 18 months ago with a particular size qubit or whatever it was. And I worked out that it would take 14 seconds to break to essentially break the entire of the Bitcoin blockchain to decode it work it out.
You can go backwards. All distributed ledgers, you can go backwards with a quantum computer.
So that gives you power that you can't imagine. So at the moment, one of the useful, from an ethical development, choke points is hardware. Quantum removes that, right? So a couple of movies I really recommend watching, Simone and Her. And Her is really interesting. Don't know if you've seen it. You sound like you look like you have, Sean. So the concept in Her, and for anyone listening, if you don't want a spoiler, just skip for 10 seconds. Basically, these intelligences get to a level where they can exist without a physical aspect to them. Right, you can start listening again if you were. And so that's the potential of we could get to. So when you create computing that becomes almost unlimited, but there are, in mathematics, there are different sizes of infinity, right? So people say, oh, you must be crazy. I always hear that. I always think that's a good line. So there's different sizes of infinity. Like there's an infinite number of positive integers. There's also an infinite number of real numbers. But there's more real numbers than positive integers because there's infinite real numbers between the positive integers.
Yes.
So it's a bigger infinity, right? So when you've got a quantum computer that doesn't care too much about that, I think we will find new ways of understanding the limits, because it's not like you create one quantum computer and it can do all calculations for all time. We will be looking at levels of infinite constraints, all new branches of mathematics. It's going to be wonderful. But scary as well, because if you connect that up to something that's super smart, like this AI, then all human knowledge will be able to be consumed and everything will be able to be created almost instantly. So you mentioned a lot of people saying, oh, this is the end times. Do something about it is what I'd suggest to people. And next time someone whinges, if you're listening to this and you whinge about AI is going to kill us all, it's like, well, do something. It's like saying, oh, this person's going to walk into the bank and kill us all. Do something about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's really interesting because in that ethical and bias perspective, right, we're kind of, in a lot of ways, outside of the AI space, we're kind of throwing a little bit of a tantrum saying, no, AI needs to be ethical. It needs to have no bias. We want AI to be better than us because we're not always ethical. and we have bias ourselves in what we're doing. So we actually want AI to fix it. And I push back on that quite a bit. And I say, okay, I get it. We want AI to be ethical and not have bias. How about we become more ethical in our business practices?
You're absolutely right. People have to act better. But for someone, you know, if let he who's perfect throw the first stone or whatever it is, yeah. a bit of wisdom yeah. in that. And I don't think you want to wait before getting better. The idea is, hey, stop throwing stones here.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
improving. But I would, what I've got a fundamental argument. There's two schools of thought. There's everyone else and then there's me. So everyone's like, oh, you got to fix the bias in the machine. I propose that artificial intelligence and intelligence itself is a bias machine.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly yeah. the same thing. You're basically at a zero state if you have no bias at
yeah,
all.
Yeah.
Nothing is computed.
Yeah, and yeah. and so it doesn't mean you prefer, you know, green people over blue people. I'm picking colors that hopefully don't exist, but it's not that you prefer one of those things. But for instance, if I use a tool I often use called Midjourney to create an image of a hospital, it will always put attractive, young, Western yeah. female nurses in there. That's bias. But it also puts clean floors, hospital lights, hospital, the rest of it. All of that is bias.
No patients in the hallways. No, yeah.
But it creates your ideal Chicago Hope view of a hospital that it's been trained on.
Yeah.
We need to give it better data. So it's really critical here who's looking in the mirror. If AI is a cultural mirror and we are biased, we have bias. And if I have a bias in the morning, I want to eat bacon. That is my bias, right? Yeah. So we are a collection of biases. The question is, are they harmful? So if I eat bacon instead of eating cereal, is that harmful to someone? Okay, you could argue, you know, it's harmful to the pig or whatever. Let's put that aside. Weet-Bix versus muesli. There we go. That is not a harmful bias, but I do have a preference.
Yeah.
And when I create a picture of a hospital, I expect that there's going to be clean floors. There's going to be people in it. So I'm not saying I can solve it, but understand bias from that perspective of, given the fact that we have an engine that uses bias to create things, how can we do it in a way that's not harmful?
Yeah, so you're saying basically bias is fine, but we need to train the engines to work with bias isn't accepted, but the harm is not accepted. You have to train it on what is harmful and what is not. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's like to become wise, you have to learn that you are not.
Yeah.
Right.
You have to be able to identify those things that are harmful bias that you don't want to have.
Yeah.
And it's not just the AI, in yourself. So if you have harmful bias in yourself, then you
invented bias. AI is a statistical engine, and statistics is the understanding of bias. Right. So if you take any group of people somewhere, you get some, you know, rough bell curve, it's a bias curve.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, are you going to find that many 3-year-olds shopping in their own on the supermarket? No. That is a bias that makes complete sense. Are you going to find 33-year-old people in the supermarket shopping? Yes, you probably are. They might have a 3-year-old with them. Now, when you create a picture of, you know, a family shopping in the supermarket, no one howls out, oh my God, bias. But it is, because you go to the supermarket and you expect to find meat. Now, a vegan might say, you're biased because I shop at Whole Foods and they don't have meat. It is bias. But it's only whether it's harmful to one group or another that it matters. That is a question that needs to be kind of resolved. And the most important thing is that first we accept it and understand it, that we all have bias and we operate to that. We all have preferences, whatever those things might be. So test the machine. And this is where what you can use AI to test itself. You can use one engine to test itself. You can actually best is using one engine to test a different engine. So use Anthropic to test Cohere or something like that.
Yeah.
And you test for failure, test for problems. Yeah. And then you go
corner cases. Yeah.
And then like back to our discussion 5 minutes ago, be a better person, generate better data.
Yeah. So you also said just over 5 minutes ago, you know, do something about it. Mm. It is upon you. And I agree with that. But also, how do we get to the point where we can actually, who do we go to? So, you know, yeah. I have my own biases and so forth, and I know what my ethics are.
This is
are.
The best time. I don't know when this podcast is being put out, but an election coming up is the best time. You know what I do right now? And I have done this. I stay quite connected to the technology responsible people in each of the parties. I'm not a political person, but I'm very interested in policy. So I stay connected and I give them my thoughts for free. I don't charge for this. What you have, people have to work out what they want. If they're scared of it, say that. Tell your local MP, tell your party. You can do it privately. You can do it publicly. You can use Threads or X or Facebook or whatever you want.
Yep.
And I think what I commonly hear is that people overall don't feel that they know a lot about it. They are concerned about it. The thing that is required is some form of regulation. It is also, there is no point in New Zealand going completely its own way. You can be early, but there's no point in being different, because if there's a fundamentally freer or different way of doing things in Australia, everyone will do stuff there. Yeah. These companies like I run, they're weightless. We can run them anywhere. Yeah. I could call an Australian company today and it's running tomorrow. So this is where foreign policy and domestic policy will be very highly tied. This is where the police investigation agencies, they tend to coordinate really well around the world, because if you enforce a global drug cartel, you need to do it all at the same time, because they are talking on phones.
They move. Yeah, and they move.
They move. And yeah, heard about what was, I mean, the technology that they're on, they're years ahead of what we're using. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
They're running, they've got their own operating system, some of these cartels. It's extraordinary. So that's where we need to get to. I tell any politician that I need, get your artificial intelligence policies out, aim to align them. We can't have this changing all the time.
So basically a United Nations for AI.
Yeah.
So that there are, because there's always going to be outliers. There are always going to be North Koreas.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there has to be a global police. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know how you police it. And that gets onto another thing. And I think some of the policing will be done through militarily. I think if I guessed forward, and again, I'm realistic about this, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw proactive strikes on certain locations in certain countries that looked like they were developing advanced AI capability. I don't know. I'm just guessing. Mm. We've seen that with nuclear technology. I mean, you saw that with the US with the zero-day attack on Iran's nuclear
infrastructure. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Amazing, amazing. They just made everything run just a little bit fast and broke it down.
Yeah.
So you've seen things like that. You've seen the military attacks on preemptive attacks to take out certain types of things that could be a worry. We could see that. I don't want to. The way to avoid that is to bring people in, I believe, into this global circle, the global compact of, AI, because AI will do anything we want it to.
Yeah.
The problem we have is that it's the people at the very edges. There's 8 billion of this, or probably more by now. We all want something a bit different. We get along well enough that, you're sitting in my lounge, we could go out for a beer, but I bet we could find something we could argue about. Mm. You imagine two supercomputers arguing. Man, they're going to get feisty. They're going to send around. You think of this. They can generate an email to the service company at the power company to get them turned off.
Yep.
So that's why we need some kind of an ethical governance base, where all of these big, powerful models are trained from. So in the context, and that's what I think needs to be agreed before there's a breakaway where you just can't control it.
Which is why I guess these individuals, I don't know how many of them were, but they asked for a pause on it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how genuine all of those members that signed this decree were, because then you have, the likes of Elon Musk then going out and starting his own AI company just months after it.
Talk is cheap, but I think it's better that something was said. And I think it aligns with the Oppenheimer letter. There were two, weren't there? There was one to Roosevelt from Einstein saying we should build it, and there was one afterwards saying, whoops, maybe we shouldn't. The fascinating thing, and the lesser known story about that, is in 1946 that lots of people saying, the US, you're the only country that's got this power. Maybe we should basically throw it all away and lock it all up and throw away the key. And the US said, okay, but Russia wouldn't.
Yeah. That's the thing is that, so we saw this what was it, a year and a half ago, when there was a United Nations thing that went around that said they weren't going to put intelligent AI systems that can make decisions with weapons. And the US and Russia refused to sign it.
Wouldn't sign it. It's, you know why? Because the US already has.
That's right.
I won't say how I've seen it, but you know, this is stuff that's actually available on YouTube. I just don't want to encourage it. But this drones and these things are unmanned. They're launched, they're given a set of parameters, kill parameters, lovely window, lovely words, and a kill window of an area and a time, and they do their own work. It's already happening. That's why you don't sign it. It's a worry. This is very negative. What's something positive we could say? No, carry on.
Go ahead, Alistair.
No, I didn't. I just laughed. It was all very negative. I mean, I think what I would love to see is how New Zealand can become a bit of a powerhouse in AI. And you touched earlier on about, you know, the funding and the capital, but it's not just a matter of capital. There's also a matter of intellect here, and we've got some great brains. So is there any way that we can still put New Zealand on the map, regardless of where the funding comes from? Do you think there's a way that we could potentially bring the best out of New Zealand and we have for Rocket Lab or so forth?
Yeah, look, I do think so. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have 3 PhDs on my team, and I like hiring people. I especially like hiring smart people, you know. Mm. You can talk about anything and everything, people thinking deeply, and I just, you know, My goal was to hire every AI PhD coming out of a New Zealand university. That's my goal. Don't have the money to do it. But I just think, wow, just think of the things that we could create. But part of it is I like hiring people into what hopefully we've built, which is a great company culture. And what can we do with New Zealand for leadership on this area? There's a handful of things. So the brains and the money go, they are correlated. We have lost brains because of the lack of money. So how do we make it appealing? So we want to ensure that this is a great place to be. It's not just about paying people more. But I'll give you a couple of examples that I have thought of. So one of the big issues with AI, along with that old dusty thing that no one talks about anymore, blockchain, is power usage.
Yeah.
New Zealand has uniquely high level of renewable power. We could have it at 100%, although there's a few decisions have been taken. And some parties are talking about, you know, reversing that. I think that's really pretty short-minded. But what if we made renewable energy available for data centers and became a processing powerhouse here?
Mm.
So AWS is opening up a zone. Microsoft's opening up a zone here. They will hoover up a lot of hardware engineer type people. Now, of course, that's cloud, so it can operate anywhere. But inevitably, just as there's some real big data centers in Seattle, right? Inevitably, you build a diaspora around that. They may leave, they may come back. But how about incredible support from universities around that? I think New Zealand has an amazing university system, for instance. And I went to Auckland University and got a degree there. The CTO at Ambit, Blair Woods, he went to Waikato University. These are great universities. I know I've only heard good stories about them. We can make sure those people have great, great, great roles. Callaghan Innovation has done a fabulous job over the last number of years supporting companies, especially when they had their growth grant available, doing genuine R&D.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's fabulous to encourage that.
But our R&D investment is like the lowest in the OECD per capita.
It is quite strange, isn't it? And it's really low, and it's partly, again, it's the capital availability because people have never done it, I think. R&D here is pretty much how can I dry the milk powder quicker? And a lot of the R&D money goes to, I won't call out specific names, but goes to big companies doing something.
Agritech.
Particularly Agritech. R&D. There's some use, and there's a few handy enzymes and that kind of thing. But I think that tech is, what is it, our second largest industry or something
It is. And it's on track to eclipse agritech within, I think, the next 2 years.
Exactly. And so there's a lot of things there. Why not? I'd love to do it. I'll put my hand up. How about opening up a dedicated school, part of a subset of the university system within each computer science department dedicated to AI learning. Because what's happening in the moment, if you go into, I was on talk about this about the future of education. If you go into a degree next year, like my twin boys are going into a degree next year, the degree you end up with, no one's heard of at the moment. Yeah, it might be called the same. It might be an LLB, but you can put money on it that's going to be fundamentally different. Same in computer science. And I think you need to accelerate the learning in certain areas, because spending 6 years doing a thesis on something that was out of date 5 years ago is no fun for anyone, right? Yeah. People, and I don't believe this PhD in a weekend nonsense, but give them PhD level of education in a different way. Come to work at my company, work with one of you two, and come up with really creative solutions. People are using LLMs to understand how to compromise an attack surface in a cybersecurity world and come out with incredibly, incredibly sophisticated attacks, all based on generative AI. That's a cool thing to work on. That's worth it. We can export that. So we can export it weightlessly by not sending milk powder, not sending logs. And those are good industries, right? We need food. And I think it's great to start self-sufficient from a food perspective. But what if, as we grow our population, we bring people up, we train people, and we import people? Because that happens. And I saw this through COVID. I had investors who were Edmund Hillary Fellowship investors, but they couldn't get into the country. So because they were told no because of COVID. And then these people with millions of dollars who make jobs, you know where they go? They go to the USA. I'll say, okay, you come over here. And it's not that I don't think that New Zealanders are smart enough, but it certainly is inspiring when you meet Peter Beck, you meet Rod Drury. That's inspiring, right? So let's have more people like that.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on, Alistair. That was a very good. Tim, look, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to sit down with us. This has been absolutely, and we did meander a little bit, and I knew we were, but this has been an absolute fabulous conversation. Look, I want to speak for Alistair in this and say that we would love to have you back on in the future. I think you're just brilliant, and just sitting and talking to you about random stuff. And the next time I get up to Auckland, I'll ping you and we can go out and I'll buy you a beer. And
I would love to. Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think my pitch to you was, I follow your stuff. Let's talk. We'll talk about something random. Yeah. So hopefully I've delivered. And if you give me an agenda, I might even stay on topic.
I think the agenda was perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, Alistair and I actually talked about that ahead of time. We were like, oh, do we want to have a formal agenda? And Alistair's like, no, just a couple bullet points that we can like work towards. And I thought the conversation was really good and I really appreciate it.
No, it's fabulous. Thanks for your time, both of you.
Thank you. Cheers.